series called Population Perils. I wondered whether I should use that title, because one of the problems with talking about population issues is some of the alarmist rhetoric that exists. And maybe if you remember 1968, some of you may remember 1968 and Paul Ehrlich's population bomb. You know, language of bomb, it's explosive, it's gonna, you know, blow up and everybody will perish. There's good cause to avoid that kind of rhetoric, but at the same time, there are definitely some perils that we face by population and consumption issues. So, despite some of the concerns about alarmist rhetoric, I think the population perils sort of theme works well as a way to address sort of a nexus of issues, not just population. So today, the board says conceptual and demographic perils. We've got 2 days to work through a bunch of stuff. Conceptual perils, consumption perils. We'll start with consumption before we talk about population growth. Then some population growth in developing world kind of data. Then tomorrow, ecological perils and moral perils. Now we got 2 days, 2 hours. If we don't get through all of it, that's fine. You ask questions as they occur to you. I'll be going through a bunch of overhead, so it's sort of disjointed anyway, and you just stick your hand in there and say, I've got a question, or clarify this, or that's really a crazy thing you just said, or whatever. So let's be fairly informal about this. I'll try to avoid John saying there will be discussion at the end. Hopefully we can just do this as we go. Last week I did some sessions on population growth, food supply, and we just sort of took questions as I went, and I think that worked very, very well. So we'll just see how much we get through today. In terms of the connection to the theme, a foretaste of the feast to come, one of the, I think, realities, or as close to reality as the future can be, is that in all likelihood the world will have about twice as many people on the planet by the middle of the next century. So when we talk about the foretaste for the feast to come, at least in earthly terms, we need to be thinking about how we're going to care for twice as many people in the world. And in a minute, I'll show you where those folks are going to be. And they're going to pose significant challenges for their own countries and for the rest of us who want to live a life whose loyalties transcend national boundaries. Christian Church is one of the original transnational corporations, and we have an obligation, it seems to me, to care not only about those in our own nation, but for all people around the world. So, any questions about just sort of the layout of the land here, or any opening kind of remarks? I'm going to talk first about some conceptual perils. One of the dangers, talking about population growth is that we can get fairly easily and quickly wrapped up in alarmist rhetoric or in a perspective that says, well, they have a population growth problem. And that finger normally points to the developing world, and we're okay, but they have a problem. And what that serves to do is, you know, by focusing on their problem, is to, of course, ignore any of our own problems and ignore some of the population issues which we face. In the international community, I've had the good fortune, and pure good fortune, I did not earn it, it was grace, but over the course of the last year, I've had the privilege of I have a cold, and I keep ripping my nose. I had the privilege of attending the United Nations International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo in September, and then from December on have been serving on a national task force associated with President Clinton's Council on Sustainable Development. And so I've just had an opportunity to wrestle with these issues in ways that perhaps many theological ethicists have not had the chance to do. But in the international community, when people start talking about population growth, if the next word out of your mouth is not consumption, you better be prepared to catch it in the teeth. What does that mean? It means that people in the developing world are tired of people like us, not you necessarily, but people like us in North America or in Europe, Northern Europe, pointing to the developing world and saying, you are the cause of the world's problems. And there's been a lot of very good reflection over the last 5 years on the real relationship between population growth, poverty, and environmental degradation. It does exist, and I'm going to talk about that tomorrow a little bit when I talk about some ecological perils. But if that's all we talk about is population growth, poverty, and environmental degradation, and don't talk about large populations like the United States, high levels of affluence, and the kinds of environmental degradation that we wreak on the world, then we're missing more than half the equation. So one of the conceptual perils in talking about population growth is to neglect consumption issues. So as I work through this presentation today, I'm going to begin with consumption issues. But one conceptual tool that helps us, I think, understand that population growth or size isn't the only thing that determines humanity's impact on the planet is an equation created by a couple of scientists in the early 70s, which I think still has plenty of currency today. I'll write it up here and then see how many of you recognize it. How many of you recognize that equation? I equals PAT. Zip. Oh boy. That's okay. Impact stands for ecological impact. Okay, so that's the big I, the big footprint we leave on the planet. Huh? So the I stands for ecological impact. And then the P, A, and T stand for three important variables. When they work together, produce this ecological impact. The first, or one of them, is population size. Okay. Bigger your population, probably the bigger impact you're going to have. A stands for affluence. The level of affluence generally, not always, but generally determines the degree of your consumption. The more wealthy you are, the more you have at least to consume if you want to, right? So large populations that are affluent generally tend to consume quite a bit, and because they are large, that leaves a fairly large impact. T stands for technology. We can be a fairly large nation with a quite affluent and be quite affluent and use completely renewable energy sources, or we can drive large vehicles that consume a great deal of fossil fuel. I am one of them. We just traded in our Jetta that got 35 miles to the gallon for a Windstar that gets 20 miles to the gallon. Now, it's a lot easier to lug two kids in the back end of that thing, but it's a lot less fuel efficient. On the other hand, I would have loved to have bought a car that got 70 miles to the gallon and still was as big as Windstar. Not doable. Point is, technology makes a big difference in terms of our impact on the planet. So when you multiply these three factors together, these are multipliers, that, according to these scientists, is a rough way of calculating a nation or a society's impact on the environment. Let me illustrate this with a couple of examples. Let's try to compare the United States with China, for example. Okay. Now, the United States is about 262 million people. China is 1.2 billion right now. On a scale of 1 to 10, if we were going to do the U.S., with 10 being the highest, what number would you plug in for the United States? We're certainly not the largest nation on the face of the planet, but we're not the smallest either. We're shooting from the hip here. This is illustrative. A 6. Fair enough. I think, maybe more closer to 7, but 6 is okay. It's up there. In terms of affluence, level of affluence, which tends to determine the amount of consumption, and sometimes even type of consumption, where would you rate the United States on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the wealthiest and 1 being, or 0 being the poorest?
9. 9. 10.
A 10 or a 9? John says 9. about a 9.5. I don't like fractions. We'll go with a 9, just for the sake of argument. And technology. Now, we are, because we're an affluent society, and because we've invested in a military-industrial complex that put people on the moon and produces a lot of very sophisticated machinery, we have an interesting mix of technologies in the United States. Not all. I mean, we have a hydro plant up here, which is a lot less harmful than burning diesel fuel in these big generators, as sometimes is necessary. So on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you rate the United States on in terms of technology, with 10 being the kind of most ecologically damaging and 1 being the least?
In terms of having it or using it?
Yes, using, I think, is
okay.
Go
about 8, 9, 10.
Can you say why you're saying that?
Well, we have a lot of technology that we don't use. For example, there are a lot of old cars on the road that are, gas hogs that ultimately wear out, but
yep.
They're still out there.
So it's basically because of our fossil fuel dependency. Okay, well, let's plug in 8. Okay, this is where I'm a liberal arts person, and math isn't my forte. 6 times 9 is 54, right?
Right.
Okay, what's 54 times 8?
432.
This is great. See, this is what it means to be a part of the community of Christ. Someone has these kinds of skills. 432, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's just a sort of that's the eye, right? That's the impact. Okay, China. I think we can fill in this first one fairly well, huh? 10?
Yeah.
Okay. Level of affluence in China.
1.
Scale of 1 to 10.
1. No.
3.
3. 4.
4.
5. Everybody on the bicycle.
Oh, yeah, right. You're up there.
3. Sounds somewhere in there. 3 on its way to 4, I think, is about where it's at. What do you want to call it? 4?
4.
Okay, 4. Now remember, this is just rough stuff, okay? Technology, anybody know about the energy path of China, how it produces most of its energy?
Coal.
Coal, exactly. And unfortunately, a very low grade of coal, so it's, quote, dirty. It's aggressively trying to explore nuclear technology, but even there, it's never going to amount to very much, and very little in the renewable source. What would you plug in here then? Another 8 or even higher? 7? What?
It would be fairly low, I think.
Say that again?
I think it would be fairly low, like 3.
Well, that's for the end consumer. There might not be that many affluent end consumers.
Yeah, you got a billion bicycles in China.
That's right, they got a billion bicycles.
Yeah. I remember when I was playing high school football, we were losing at halftime, and our coach could tell that we were kind of nervous about losing this big game, and he came in and he said, "Fellas, remember there are a billion people in China that don't give a damn whether you win or lose." It was great. Now, again, we're coming back to this business about whether you're using the technology or whether you're or whether it simply exists. But what we're talking about is a population that uses the technology that's available. So, on the one hand, we've got a lot of folks riding bikes. On the other hand, we have a utility industry that is driven primarily by coal and some other fossil fuels. Plug in a number.
5.
I'm just, you said 3. Was it 3 because the low amount of money each person has, you can't afford to buy a car if you wanted it in the first place?
I'd go higher than that. They dump wastes and street hazardous wastes.
It's in China.
Oh, not China.
Three's a little low, but say, what would you say?
I'd say close to the U.S., if not higher, because the population and the affluence then impact that number as well.
Yeah, you can see now how this is an imperfect system. Huh? It's complex. And let's pick something between 3 and 8. 5, 6? 6? All right, we'll just do that for now. Let's see where we come out.
40.
All right, 10 times 4, I can do that one. It's 40 times 6, I can do that, is 240, right? All right. China is the largest nation on the face of the earth. The United States is probably the wealthiest nation on the face of the earth. What we can see here is that the United States has almost twice the ecological impact of China. On the other hand, China has about half the ecological impact that we do. Now, just, you know, shooting from the hip, right? On the other hand, if you increase this variable, the affluence, which leads to consumption, and who's going to deny 1.2 or 1.5 billion Chinese an improvement in their standard of living? I don't know anybody in the room who wants to deny them that. And if we don't help them, or if they can't figure out how to get a cleaner energy mix, then this number is going to be multiplied, right? Which make it much closer to ours. We aren't the largest nation on the face of the earth, and yet we have, at least in comparison to the largest nation, almost twice as much of an ecological impact. Now, what have we learned from that? Probably nothing real definitive, but I think what we at least have seen is that there are at least three variables, huh? Population is only one. Level of consumption determined by affluence is at least another, and types of technology is at least a third variable. There may be others, but this is just simply one conceptual tool that helps us understand that we shouldn't just talk about population growth alone. On the other hand, another reason why population needs to be in there as an important variable, I mentioned this Saturday, the United States has a 1% population growth rate. If over the course of the next decade, which is low, but it's the highest among industrialized nations, if over the course of the next decade the United States could achieve a 10% increase in efficiency, energy efficiency, that 10% increase in energy efficiency would be washed out by a 10% net increase over a decade in population growth. So you can understand how these variables serve to mitigate each other, and why one is more, why they are all so important. After all, they are multiplied by each other. Okay. Well, you know, we could probably have a whole series just on that equation. There are some conceptual limitations to it, but
on the technology, isn't higher technology potentially less harmful to the environment?
And yes, absolutely.
Or viewing the system, being a 10 might actually be better than being a 1, yet it makes the numbers come out a lot higher.
Remember, the scale of 1 to 10 is sort of the net ecological impact of the technology. So if it, yeah, so it isn't really higher or lower in terms of 1 to 10, it's net ecological impact.
But higher technology also uses more exotic materials and processes. So, you know, it also has an impact just in the creation of the technology.
That's right. Silicone chips, up until fairly recently, used a kind of liquid, I don't know what the chemical was, in washing the boards, which was very toxic. Now, apparently, some of those companies have found ways to use a less toxic substance.
Oh, lemon juice, basically.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. All right.
Works wonders.
I think there are some limitations to this formula. One of them is that on the consumption side, it doesn't distinguish between military and non-military consumption. On the consumption side, in a nation like China, it doesn't distinguish in terms of consumption. That four doesn't distinguish between the very wealthy and the legions that are less than wealthy. It doesn't distinguish between basic and non-basic needs. Chinese folks, you know, there's a certain amount of your consumption that is, you know, you need to do in order to live. On the other hand, many of us, most of us in North America, have our basic needs met, and we choose to consume in addition to fulfill a variety of things, like going on a vacation to Holden Village, or buying a yacht, or, you know, whatever. So, this number 9 doesn't easily reflect the distinction between basic and non-basic needs, between subsistence needs and luxury goods, right? So those are limitations, but they're limitations. Other conceptual perils in talking about population issues, I think we're just going to get to conceptual and consumption and may not get to the demographic, and I'll talk about that tomorrow, is the term overpopulation. Overpopulation and carrying capacity. How many of you have heard these terms in relationship to human beings?
The first one.
Huh? Forget
forgive me, I'm not really good a writer on the board.
Normally when people use the term overpopulation, that's one of those things where, you know, the finger's pointing elsewhere. What's that?
You're referring to somebody else.
You betcha. You know, what is that about the log in your own eye? We tend to point over there. And yet Paul Ehrlich, the guy who wrote the population bomb, and you know, has some weaknesses because it was a warmist approach. On the other hand, if you want to talk about a population problem, the United States is the place with the greatest population problem. Because even though we may not be the largest nation in the world, when you put together all of the stuff we buy and the kinds of technologies we use to consume and produce our goods, we leave a much bigger ecological footprint on the planet than someone from Chad or Kenya or El Salvador or wherever. And so he says, if you're going to use this language of overpopulation, use it with the United States. Talk about the United States as the most overpopulated planet on the face of the earth. If you're thinking about them causing problems for the rest of us. His point is that we are causing most of the problems for them. I'll talk more about that tomorrow and show you that in the future, we're each going to be causing each other a great deal of peril. Carrying capacity is a term right out of the discipline of ecology, and it makes a lot of sense. You know, when the chipmunks get too large for this area, even though there's a huge amount of food here, eventually they will exceed their carrying capacity, or let's get out a whole village where you have an extra means of supply. If you're up on the hill, up on the 4th of July Basin, there's only so much food for chipmunks. And after a while, they have to either migrate or various things happen that reduce their size. Predators get rid of the surplus. The problem with carrying capacity in relationship to the human species is that human beings are not, we often say that all those people are getting so large in size that they're going to get so large beyond the carrying capacity of the agricultural productivity of the land that they live on, right? There's only so much land and you can only grow so much food. Well, what's the problem with that? How many of you have money in your pocket? Okay. How many of you could, if you chose to spend it that way, go over to the snack bar and buy yourself a sandwich? We all can do that, huh? Carrying capacity is a slippery term when it applies to human beings, because we can grow, if we could, grow some food out here. We can grow a little bit, not much. But we can grow some food in our backyards. But the bottom line is we have money, and we can buy food from Guatemala. We buy our bananas from Honduras.
We can outbid somebody else.
And we, bingo, the guy with the most money wins, huh? Law, supply, and demand. And so the problem with carrying capacity is you got nations like Japan and Denmark. There's no way they could feed their nations on the little slivers of arable land that they have. Do they look emaciated? No, because they have things to trade, and they have large stockpiles of wealth which they can draw upon to feed their nations. That, of course, is not true in many developing nations where land is unevenly distributed, where the land that is in production is often utilized to grow crops for our consumption, coffee. When I get up in the morning, I don't know what I'd do if I couldn't have my cup of coffee. But I didn't grow here, did I? So sometimes you'll hear these terms, and the reason I'm going over this is I want you to be sensitive to them and to realize that there's some value in using them, but there's also some very serious danger in using them. Questions about that? That's sort of the end of my spiel on conceptual perils. Reactions to that? Okay? You seem to be all right? All right. Well, let's talk about consumption then. I didn't separate these out correctly. Just 1 minute here, folks. There are different ways to talk about consumption perils. That is, perils, problems posed by the uneven distribution of wealth and poverty in the world. The reality is that the gap between the rich and the poor around the world is growing. It's not decreasing. And that's a constant issue which nations of the developing world bring to any international meeting. It was an important issue in Cairo. It was an important issue in Copenhagen this year on the Summit on Social Development. It will again be a big issue in Beijing in September when the United Nations Fourth International Conference on Women takes place. This huge gap between the rich and the poor. This is the World Resource Institute's estimate. Oh, sorry. Something wrong here.
Technology.
Oh, come on. There we go. Per capita gross domestic product. These things, GNP, GDP, gross national product, gross domestic product, are highly disputed by many people who think that they don't measure very well the quality of human life. All they really measure is how much junk we consume, or stuff we consume, not necessarily junk, that's a pejorative term. But in any case, that's sort of the hard and fast data that we have to work with. The purpose of this overhead is simply to show you the huge disparities in it takes wealth to produce the kinds of things which we consume. And so in the United States, the per capita GDP is 22,219. Japan, with a slightly smaller population and at this point quite a bit of wealth, you can see leads the world. But then look down here at India. Look down here at China, Sudan, Mexico. Yes?
Where do some of the countries in the European community fit?
Yeah, I'm surprised they aren't on here. They're right in here, right around the $20,000 figure. At least the excluding nations like Greece or Turkey. But the established big guns, England probably lower than Germany. Germany's pretty high. France. Spain would be a little lower.
What's the 22,219? What is that?
Well, let me put it. I have a different set of statistics that works this way. Rather than translating it into GDP, the numbers are slightly different. But the average per capita purchasing power of each person in developed nations was about $19,000. That is to say, based on the amount of money you have and the assets you have, let's just think about these numbers in that way. Forget about GDP. Just think about it in terms of purchasing power. The average person in a developing nation is right around 19,000. So those folks in European nations, and the average number for those living in developing nations was 2,377. So right somewhere in here, somewhere between a lot more. Lower than between Mexico and India. But there the problem is even more skewed if you compare, between nations, the United States and India. Look at that huge difference in purchasing power. And that boils down to wealth, folks. It's affluence. And within India, we have to understand that not all wealth in India is evenly distributed. 60% of people in India live on $600 a year or less. 60% of the people in India live on. Now, ignore that 288, because I'm talking here about purchasing power. The purchasing power of this 288 is about 1,150. So maybe I shouldn't use this. I just wanted to show you the lines and try to forget about the numbers and just listen to the purchasing power data. So what I'm trying to illustrate here is this huge gap between many Americans, many of you sitting in this room, don't think of yourselves as wealthy, right? Maybe you can always think of people who are more wealthy than we are.
You have to make $200 million a year before you finally have enough.
Exactly. And when you earn $200 million a year,
you can't spend it any faster than that's the limit.
Is that right? Is this a voice of experience? If so,
let me hook you up. But there's no matter what people are earning, if it's less than $200 million a year, that's always not quite enough for everything.
it's a. anyway, that's a, it's a, it's huge. You know, this gap between North Americans and the rest of the world. Not just North Americans either. I mean, Northern Europeans. So that's one of the realities which the world faces. And because of this huge gap, the poor simply cannot buy the land they need. They can't buy the food they need. They can't buy the education they need. They can't buy the fresh water they need. They can't buy a lot of things. This is a perilous situation. The growing gap between the rich and the poor and the implications of the relationship between population growth, poverty, and environmental degradation, as well as population size, affluence, and environmental degradation are two major problems which the planet faces over the next century that we either have to address or we will perish, or many of us will perish in an ungodly way. Another way to talk about this distribution of wealth in the world is by carving it up into billions. There are about 5.7 billion of us right now on the planet. Alan Durning wrote a book called How Much is Enough? Any of you read that? You two probably have. Anybody else here? Alan is a researcher for the group where I got these overheads, the World Resources Institute in New York. With World Watch in New York and in D.C., excuse me. Fine guy, good research, solid stuff. The way he breaks it down is as follows. Just get this erased. In terms of the first billion, 1.1 billion people on the planet live in a condition of abject poverty, at least 1.1. Some studies put it at 2 billion people. Just depends on how you define abject poverty. Anyway, the poorest fifth lives on, 1.1 billion, lives on just 2% of the world's income and earns less than $700 a year. Remember India, 60% of people living in India earn less than $600 a year. The middle three-fifths, you know, you break it into fifths, the middle three-fifths, 3.3 billion, the world's middle class, live on between $700 and $7,500, that's a big gap, a year, and they take home about 33%, a third of the world's income. Do the math. That means the rest of us living in nations like the United States, 1.1 billion, earn about more than $7,500. That's like this, right? And we take home 64% of the world's income.
Actually, have your science backwards on.
Oh, on these guys, excuse me. Let's just leave the science off, huh? All right. That number is 32 times greater than that. Yeah. Those of us, I mean, like I said, we don't think of ourselves as being the world's wealthiest people, but on average, we are. We are at least 32 times wealthier than the poorest fifth of the planet. And it's this number that's growing, and more of us here in this one are winding up in this one. That gap between the rich and the poor exists also in the United States. And there's especially since the early 80s, is a steady progression of the distribution of wealth into the hands of a few, and the purchasing power of the dollar declining so that those of you who are in the middle class find yourselves unable to buy as much with your dollar as you could have 10, 15, 20 years ago. So when I say that gap is widening, that gap is widening within our country and around the world. And for those of us that are Christians, it feels pretty contrary to the mission or the vision of the gospel that we see in the Sermon on the Mount or anywhere else in our scriptures. Comments on this? In addition to this sort of you know, major difference in terms of income or wealth, we also have huge differences in terms of consumption levels. And there's no way to easily do this. Let me just read this quote to you. This is from a UN document. By the late 1980s, wealthy developed nations represented 20% of the world's population, but consumed 85% of the aluminum and synthetic materials, 80% of paper, iron, and steel, 75% of timber and energy, 60% of meat, fertilizer, and cement, 50% of fish and grain supplies, and 40% of the world's fresh water. Now, one of the fellows that teaches with me at Luther College, he's a Milton Friedman economist from the Chicago School Economist. He says, well, that's true. We do consume that much, and it is disproportionate in respect to our percentage of the world's population. But these nations, these industrialized nations, are the ones that produce all the bloody goods that everybody enjoys and uses. Where do you think all those VCRs come from?
Hundreds of other countries now.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the poles of the argument. That's right. So, to a point, though, he has a valid point up to a certain point. But in a minute, I'll show you one of the reasons why that is flawed, just in terms of the amount of resources that it takes for us to produce something. I'll show you that in a minute. But ponder this statistic. Since the end of the Second World War, all of the people on the face of the planet have consumed as many goods and services since 1950 as all previous generations put together. Now, a lot of that's because most of the world's population growth took place in this century, or a good share of it. We've doubled since 1950, and we'll double again probably by the middle of the next century. It's just an important, before we start talking about population, we need to recognize the level of consumption that takes place in the world and understand that it is huge. According to the UN, the industrialized world uses 66% of the world's resources and generates 75% of all pollutants and wastes. So one thing we need to understand is that when we talk about global warming or ozone depletion or freshwater contamination or soil erosion, you name your ecological problem, at least generally, it is true that up to this point, the vast majority of environmental degradation to date has been perpetrated by us, okay, citizens of wealthy industrialized nations, not just the United States. In the future, however, that is going to be matched, kind of a dollar for dollar, by the large numbers of people living in the developing world who, with their even meager levels of existence, will put into the atmosphere and into the ground and into the waters the same kind of degradation that we have been doing for the last 100 or 200 years since the Industrial Revolution. That's one of the perils of population. And I'll talk more about that tomorrow. So besides a difference in consumption level, there's also a difference in type of consumption. I said earlier that residents of developing nations need to spend a larger percentage of their income simply on the products that they require to allow them to live, basic goods, basic needs. Those of us here can afford to buy our VCRs or our stereos or our tapes or our CDs or, you know, whatever. And so the here are just a couple statistics for you to think about. Families in developed nations, like myself, ourselves, my wife and I, we haven't done this yet, but you've probably done something similar. Families in developed nations spend approximately $9 billion a year on video games for their children. Now, in 1990 and 91, that was the amount of money that the United States gave away in foreign aid. That was the amount of money that Japan gave away in foreign aid. We spend almost as much now on video games, and that was a 1990 statistic. We may be spending more today on video games and electronic entertainment for our children than we spend on foreign aid. And of course, our foreign aid budget, only 30 or 25% of that is actually development assistance. Most of that goes to Israel and China. Israel and Egypt in the form of security assistance, weapons transfers, things like that, military credits. So that's a sobering kind of thing. Think about what we spend our money on. The average Lutheran gives less than the price of a Big Mac to the ELCA World Hunger Appeal every year. About $2.29, as I understand it, goes per person. Now, of course, John Furnish said to me the other day, and of course, many Lutherans give zip, and many other Lutherans, or some of the Lutherans, give a lot more than one Big Mac a year. Just think about the ways we consume, what we choose to spend our money on. That's the point. Another thing to ponder is that 40% of the world's grain supply is diverted to feed animals so that I can eat my hamburger at McDonald's, right? 40% of the world's grain goes to feed animals so that for those who enjoy a meat-based diet. And then American teens and their parents, Luther College has sports camps every summer, you know, basketball camps primarily. And I play noon ball Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and you go out there and you see these kids, and I've got a decent pair of Nike high tops that cost me $60. But most of those kids out there have $100 or $125 high tops or shoes. Now think about it. Remember I said 1.1 billion people in the world live on $700 a year or less. 60% of the nation of India lives on $600 or less. $125 for a pair of Nike high tops represents 25% of the annual income of one person living in China, in India. Think about that. Think about how we spend. Now, you know, there's. I know you can't. It's not completely apples and apples here, but it works well enough to get a sense on different kinds of consumption, and people living in the developing world who hear us as a nation come and say, boy, I don't know if we can live up to our UN pledge of donating 0.7% of our GNP towards development assistance. They say, bullshit. Look at what you spend your money on. You know, how can you say that? Well, it seems to me when you hear data like that, that it's, excuse me for the offensive language, right? I shouldn't do that. Cut that out of the tape. But, you know, there is a time for profanity, and Martin Luther threw the inkwell at the devil in the corner. There is a time to get animated about this and to say, that's wrong, you know, or at least on the face of it as a Christian theological ethicist, it appears to me to be wrong. And it seems to me it's a moral challenge and a moral peril that we all face. The unique role of the United States, with the world's largest economy, the U.S. is the world's largest consumer of natural resources. Got another thing here to show you. This is a historical, from the beginning of the century to date. Stop. There we go. This is million metric tons. This represents then about 8 billion, you know, you can take off the zeros and stuff, so it's about, actually this is now up around 9 billion metric tons by the year 1990, or somewhere up in there, that's my understanding anyway. You can see the depression here, 1930s, when our economy really slowed down, then the post-World War II boom, that took place from the 50s on, and basically that, you know, you can see dips as recessions occur, but it's basically an upward trajectory. It takes about 9 billion metric tons of goods or products, natural resources, to drive our economy. We're the world's largest economy. 9 billion metric tons. Of that, 4.5 billion metric tons is waste. And then the rest is a product which we consume, which then 2 billion tons of that winds up in the waste stream as well. It's an incredibly inefficient economy when you think about it that way. So as a economic leader in the world, we have to understand that there's a toll. We are very inefficient in our use of resources, and that means that we chew through a lot of stuff. Every day on average, each North American consumes his or her body weight
in resources extracted from farms, forests, rangelands, and mineral deposits. Now, when you go to the, when you go to fill up your coffee cup, I don't know how much that weighs, but it's not very much. It's hard to believe that, especially here at Holden, that we consume our body weight every day in natural resources. But think about the buildings. Think about the hospital that you use once or twice, maybe even in your lifetime. Think about the amount of energy, materials, products that go into that. All of those things, think about the freeway that you'll drive away on when you finally get off the boat. You know, think about all the things, all the telephone wires that are strung around, all of the things that make our life possible, and then you begin to understand how you could, if you divided it annually, you could achieve your body weight in materials every year. That's a lot. And as a result, then, the U.S. is also a world leader in environmental degradation. Not surprisingly, we produce more municipal waste per capita than any other country on Earth. And we are probably the world's largest producer of toxic wastes, although because of the breakup of the former Soviet Union, it's very hard to tell exactly what's going on in some of those nations with nuclear technology and other very complex technologies. So this issue of consumption is a huge one. In the United States, the reality, however, is that our per capita use of almost all resources is declining, except for paper and plastic. Paper and plastic per capita continue to increase as our packaging is primarily focused around paper and plastic.
Junk mail
is huge. And, you know, the computer revolution didn't do what it was supposed to do, right? We're supposed to have a paperless world? Hardly. You know, I've never seen more paper. You ought to see the box that I filled up writing my dissertation just with, you know, first drafts of whatever. So our per capita use of paper and plastic is going up. But every other thing, industrial minerals, secondary metals, primary metals, wood, agricultural products, all of those things are declining, not by gigantic amounts, but we as a nation, since the first oil shock in the 70s, have become more efficient. And in terms of energy, are much more efficient. We've accomplished, I think, about a 25%, or depending on what you look at, 15 to 25% energy efficiency, and we could probably go a lot more than that. We definitely could go a lot more than that. But, get this one. Our total use of resources is higher every year, even though our per capita consumption rate is down. Why is that? Who said that?
Population.
Hey, there's Ferrix up in the corner. Exactly. It's because our population is growing. We're growing at 1% a year, which means we'll double in about 70 years. And so even though you've got this great decline in per capita consumption, that population variable, remember, you got the affluence variable determining consumption, but you got that P variable, which even at a steady rate of 1% makes a big difference. So that's why population stabilization is important for every nation, especially for the United States. I think I'm going to stop there. It's 11:21. I was going to, you know, it said demographic perils. We never got there. I'll talk about demographic, ecological, and give you an overview of some of the major moral perils posed by all that data tomorrow. This gets us, I feel better starting a discussion on population by talking about these conceptual and consumption perils before I start talking about, pull out my other charts about population growth. So let me stop there, pull up the screen, get a little more light in the room, and get some reactions to what I've said. Yeah.
What is the average size of an American family? Because I was thinking, mm-hmm, if you just take two kids, mm-hmm, then eventually be zero poverty.
Exactly. That's what the world needs to. It's not necessarily that everyone has to have two. Someone can have three, and one group can have one, and you put them together, you got two, right? So I've been on this task force for the President's Council on Sustainable Development on population consumption, focusing on the United States, and that was one thing we
rigorously avoided was trying to say, okay, each one of you shall have two children and not more. You know, bad idea. You know, if you want to generate a lot of hostility with people, do that. It just makes people mad. You know, you try to tell them what they should do with their, well, think about sexuality right now. You know, any discussion of sexuality gets people mad, no matter what it is.
But won't that be a necessity in the future?
Exactly right. The goal, however, is to reach replacement rate. Replacement rate fertility is 2.1. You need the two makes sense. You got mom and dad. You have two kids. They're replaced by their two children. The 0.1 you need because not every kid makes it, even in an industrialized society. My kid almost didn't make it. He fell off the wall the other day and landed flat on a rock and put 6 stitches in his head. You know, a little higher up, and who knows what would have happened to him. Now, the interesting thing about the United States is that, A, our population growth rate is going up, not down. This was a huge surprise in 1990 when the U.S. Census Bureau, well, it was, I think the data came out in 1992, but it was based on the 1990 U.S. Census. And the census indicated that our average fertility rate, which had been around 1.7 to 1.8 in the 1970s and early 80s, had suddenly gone up to 2.1%. That is a very large jump in a very short period of time. It has taken the international community 40 years to bring population growth down from 2.1 to 1.7%. No, excuse me, I'm talking about population growth and fertility as two different things. But in any case, this increased fertility was unexpected. And there are three main causes for it. There are two main causes for the increased fertility, and there are three causes for population growth in the United States. But in terms of fertility, half of it is chalked up to increased fertility among boomers, baby boomers like myself. My wife and I have two children, but we've had three miscarriages, and our last pregnancy was a miscarriage, an unintended pregnancy, but nevertheless, we would have been at three then, not the two, right? Reality is that people my age or in my generation are having more children than the previous generation did. And fertility is higher among recent immigrant groups. And there the data does not break down or does not easily break down between legal and illegal immigrant populations. But the reality is that there, and it's not large. I mean, we're talking about 2 or 3/10 of a percent higher. So instead of being 2.28 for my cohort, it's 2.3 or 2.48 for someone from a Hispanic background or from an Asian background. So we're not talking about gigantic differences in fertility, but nevertheless, you know, enough to have boosted us up. So that's got some folks concerned because you double the size of this nation and you double a lot of issues. You know, it is true that with each person comes a mouth, but a brain and two hands. There's no doubt about it. We will be a, you know, you're always blessed by children, right? It's when they become adults that they become a pain in the neck. And so the reality is these kids are going to grow up, and so you got to deal with that. In terms of the population growth rate in the United States, besides fertility, then the other factor, you have births and deaths, and then migration. And it's the migration issue that I'm going to talk about on Thursday, at least in terms of illegal immigration. But the estimates are that with our 1% growth rate, about a third of it is chalked up to increased fertility from people like me. A third of it is chalked up to recent immigrant populations, and a third of it is chalked up to both illegal and legal immigrants entering the country. And when you add all that up, you get that 1% growth rate. Okay.
Does it have something to do with the number of years we live?
Exactly. I'm going to get to that tomorrow when I talk about causes of population growth. One of the causes of population growth is that people in our country and in developing countries are simply living longer. And in developing countries, it's even more of a amazing miracle than it is in the United States. But without dragging back my notes, I can say that I think we've, since 1950, our average life expectancy has increased from 60-something to 70-something. And in the developing world, it's gone from 40-something, really 39, to 62. That's a huge jump. Lots of people living longer. That's one of the reasons for population growth. And I'll talk another misconception. Some of you may not be here tomorrow, so I'll just throw this out now. Another misconception, or and it's not misconception, but it's a natural assumption. When you think about population growth, you think, well, gosh darn it, you know, why don't they just tie a knot in that thing? They're having too many kids, you know. That's not the case. People around the world are having fewer children than ever before. The problem is there are more of us having children. I'll talk more about the causes for that. There are simply more people in the world of prime reproductive age than there have ever been in the history of the world. And when you multiply that base by even 3, as opposed to 6, which it was in most of the developing world 40 years ago, 50 years ago, it's a huge contribution, annual contribution.
Jim, that $7,500 that 64% of us...
Purchasing power.
Well, it's so hard to live in the U.S. with $7,500. Do you have any statistics on those of us in the United States, what the gaps are?
Well, the in the United States, remember, the U.S. average purchasing power is 22,000. Remember that 7,500 figure was for the globe. That just shows even. I mean, that's just because you broke it into fifths. It's an arbitrary line. We could divide it into tenths, and then we'd really see the elites. But it works well in terms of fifths because you got 5 billion, and it makes nice not round numbers.
Where's the government define the poverty line today?
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of that average. What's the gap between?
Right.
The
it changes, and I. Anybody know this better than I do?
The $15,000.
And what is it for a family of four?
Something in the mid 20s.
22, 23.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
When you start playing with averages, it's kind of interesting to see how those compare.
Yeah. I don't know what it is, but other states, but worse than it.
In reality, those figures are way off base when you meet face-to-face with the poor, like you do when you're on a food bank and meet people every day.
Yeah.
And
because Trump's money's in there along with the guy who's visiting your food bank, and Trump raises that average a lot.
But there are people where I live who are making, they're lucky to make $700 a month.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a flat tire on their car will break the budget.
Yeah.
So you have to look at the realities of the poor people in this country.
That's right. Who was it? There was someone gave a session last week about a guest questioned the rate of species extinction and compared it to the reality that, in fact, many species have expired over the course of natural history. But the respondent said, well, you know, there are lies, damn lies, and then there are statistics. And these statistics often lie. They hide a multitude of sins, and this is one of them, this business about 7,500 or 22,000. Doesn't identify the reality for very many people, and the income of a few skews the statistical representation. What else? What other kinds of reactions or comments?
Is the China program of what, one child working out, or?
It's I do a whole separate thing on that. I haven't done that here. You know, it's a very controversial proposal. They went to a one-child guideline for primarily urban, for most people, but certainly for urban residents in the late 70s. 1983 was a kind of year of infamy for the Chinese program because that was the year that they hit their peak of coerced sterilizations, coerced abortions, a lot of really terribly unfortunate things. And the Chinese government has said from day one that coercion is not to be an element of this. But it's because of the way it's structured. The policy is implemented by people at the base. In local communities, they have quotas to reach. You know, you give some people a quota, and by God, they'll do anything to get there. you know, and they're operating on a good consequentialist utilitarian logic, and others will say, well, there's some things we can't do to meet this quota. So there have been real violations. The reality is that even with the aggressive population policy to limit fertility to one child for, as I said, mostly urban residents, the nation is going to reach 1.5 billion almost with certitude. Now, it was going to reach 2 billion with certitude if they hadn't done that. Now, you imagine the world with another 500 million people in it. It's a lot of folks.